Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. We've focused many of our programs on how public school curriculums have changed in the past 25 years. Core subjects like reading, writing, and math are the priorities in school in order to prepare students for the world whose skills will be essential. Of course, some would say high-stakes standardized testing in those subjects are the real reason those subjects get so much time in the classroom. Against a backdrop of tight budgets, the importance of test scores, many schools have cut art, music, and theater programs, leaving students to do without or seek other outlets for arts education. And that's what we're going to be discussing in the first part of today's program. Our guest, Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra music director and conductor, Maestro Stuart Molina. Maestro Molina, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's great to be here.
Also joining us, Mark Hunsberger is director of education and youth symphony administrator with the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Hunsberger, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in on the arts in central Pennsylvania, across the country, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. All right, music and the arts are something that, Mr. Molina, that you obviously are very passionate about. This is what you do for a living. Why is it so important to our society?
Well, I think that arts are part of what defines what a society is. I mean, if you think back in history, even a long time in history, you remember either the political leaders, and mostly for their atrocities, and you remember the great works of art. I mean, you can think back and you can talk about Michelangelo. You can talk about even the great cave artists. These are the legacy that we leave of what our culture is all about. And I think that it would be a very sad thing if we had a lost generation of kids that don't appreciate art, or even worse, that don't create art.
When you say a lost generation, I mean, there may be some people who would say, well, okay, just because there are some schools that have cut back arts education, does that mean we're going to lose a generation?
Well, you know, I probably was overstating to a certain degree. I do think that the creators of art are going to create art, and I think that that's an innate thing. That's not something that's taught. But the appreciation of art is really important because there has to be a culture that is welcoming of these artists. These artists somehow have to find a way to survive. And the art needs to be seen and needs to be appreciated. I think it just becomes kind of a bleak world. Listen, I studied math. I studied science. I was going to be a math major when I went to college. I very much believe in the STEM education. But I do think that it needs to be enhanced by arts education in order for humans to be fully rounded, well-rounded humans.
I had never heard that you were going to be a math major.
Oh, yeah, okay, I loved math.
Okay, the arts, music, and math, you're weighing the two. What made you decide on a music career?
Oh, my math teacher was insanely boring. that really is the truth. I went to my first day of class. I was completely turned off by it, and the first day of music was incredibly cool. So at the end of my freshman year, I became a theory and composition major. And actually, I think there is a lot of interconnectedness between the sciences and music. And there have been study after study after study of the way that creative thinking enhances scientific and mathematical thinking. And also the way that for younger kids, arts education increases the incentive to come to school in the first place and to stay in school and to enjoy school. And so, you know, it's easy to say, okay, we have limited funds, so let's just cut the arts because they're the non-necessary things, and I say necessary in quotations. But I do think that it's short-sighted to look that way, because I think that the study of sciences gets injured in and of itself if you don't study the arts with it.
You know, you mentioned some of the great artists. Right now, there's a book out. In fact, this was a number one bestseller, New York Times bestselling list on Da Vinci this week. Now, there's someone that is known for more than just art.
He was the Renaissance man. I mean, he defined what a Renaissance man was. He was a scientist. He was a visual artist. He was a poet. He really kind of embraced the full extent of what human thinking is capable of. And you could also think of it, I sometimes refer to it in a religious way. If you're a religious person, I mean, you were created in God's image, and God is the creator. And the creation of art is, I think, the closest thing that we come to that definition of godliness. So I find it very difficult to understand the thought that the arts are secondary, that literature is secondary to nonfiction, that the study of great visual art is unimportant. I think this is crucially important on so many different levels.
Now, not everyone who works in the arts is Da Vinci, obviously.
Of course.
But at the same time, the reason I brought that up is because some of the things you already mentioned, critical thinking. I mentioned in the introduction that today's education, there is so much emphasis on standardized tests. They are so important. They are high stakes to schools, to teachers, to students. But one of the big criticisms, other than teaching to the test just to pass those core subjects, is that it doesn't promote critical thinking. In what way do the arts promote critical thinking?
Well, when you're looking at the arts, it's non-objective. It's completely subjective. It forces you to think about what your preferences are, what emotion it evokes in you. It forces you to think about things in different ways. When you're dealing with mathematics, there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. There is no real critical thinking involved in solving an arithmetical formula. When you're listening to a piece of music or reading a work of literature and the question is, well, what do you make of this? It forces you to really think outside the box, because there's no other way to think about art. Art is not black and white. Art is something that is created that will hopefully evoke some kind of an emotional and or rational reaction. But I do think it's important to think that way. And when you think about the scientific process, that's an inherently creative process. And if you're not trained in thinking outside the box, the scientific process becomes reproving things that have been proven before.
Then why are there so many people who don't recognize that? And when I say so many people, I'm talking about schools that have tight budgets and they have to make decisions on teachers to employ, programs that they will keep, that they will cut. Government. We know that the National Endowment for the Arts was on the chopping block last year when President Trump came up with his first budget, along with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Those things have been restored. I guess restored. Maybe is not the right way, because it never really left. But still, why aren't there more people who recognize just what you described?
Well, you know, in terms of the National Endowment for the Arts, we could do an entire one-hour session just talking about that. I think you really hit the nail on the head right at the beginning. When you have limited resources, I do think fear comes into play. And the fear is that the kids aren't going to have a competitive edge in the job market. And I think that the traditional thinking is that science and math is going to lead to those thinkers that are going to have successful careers in engineering. I hate to say that these people are ignorant, because they're not. Many of them are very intelligent thinkers. But I do think that it involves a certain lack of forethought in thinking that it's enough just to study those areas. We have two sides of our brain. We've got the creative side and we've got the rational cognitive side. And they enhance each other. And if you just study the arts without the sciences, I think you're missing out on a lot. And if you just study the sciences without the arts, I think you're not going to think as well about the sciences as you would otherwise. Why do people feel this way? Well, it's a very tough question. But I do think it really boils down to having limited resources, worrying about funding. because schools are evaluated based on test scores. They're not evaluated based on how many kids make all-state band or orchestra. And so those are the things that the schools have to focus on. If you have a certain score and you get less money, you're going to have to put that money into getting higher scores. I don't believe in that kind of an education. I think that teachers should have much more latitude to be able to teach creatively, arts and otherwise. But I do think that's what it stems from. It's just this school board is faced with a budget crunch. They can't raise taxes because that's politically unfeasible. And so what do they do? Well, we can't cut math, so let's cut the arts. And it's sad. I think it's unfortunate for the kids. And I think in the end, it really doesn't help anything.
And, you know, again, there is some irony in this, in that if you look at what four-year universities are looking for example, when a student applies, especially at, you know, some of the schools that are more difficult to get into, they want to see a well-rounded person.
Yes, they do.
They don't want to see just someone who, you know, maybe got straight A's, and I don't know whether they grade by letter grade anymore or not, but someone who did very well academically. They want to see those extracurricular activities. They want to see that there's some critical thinking involved with the student. So it's you wonder whether, okay, we know that the schools, the public education, is trying to prepare students for the outside world, but are they preparing them for that four-year university if that's what a student decides to do?
Well, you know, that's a whole other question, too. I have a daughter who's a senior in high school, and so we've just been going through this process. I'm very pleased to say she's a very good student, but she also plays the cello. She's also involved in school activities. This is what you have to do now to get into college. But I'm encouraged by the fact that there are more colleges that are putting less emphasis on scores, on test scores, and less emphasis necessarily on GPA, and more emphasis on the holistic approach to students, students that are going to enhance the culture of the college beyond just academics. It's a small baby step, but I do think it's a step in the right direction. And I do think that what you find, interestingly, in a lot of cases, is the kids that are excelling in the arts are also excelling in academics, and that the kids who are best at academics are the most likely to have some exposure to and some experience creating art.
And, of course, there has been research that has shown that young people who do well, I mean, that are involved in the arts, do better academically.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a lot of theories as to why that's the case. I hit on just the enjoyment theory before, that they enjoy being at school more because they're doing the arts. But I do think that it really stems more into this creative thinking idea. That it forces you to think about things in different ways, and creative thinking, even in the most cognitive, firm academic subjects like mathematics, I do think it just makes you do better.
We're going to talk about what Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra is offering in the way of arts education in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by the team of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, physicians assistants, and rehabilitation specialists from Pinnacle Health Cardiovascular Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, delivering a broad range of traditional and highly specialized procedures.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're speaking with Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra music director and conductor Maestro Stuart Molina. Mark Hunsberger is going to come into our conversation. He's the director of education and youth symphony with the administrator with the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra. We're talking about arts education. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Now, before we take some phone calls, Mark Hunsberger, wanted to bring you into the conversation. You are the Director of Education and Youth Symphony Administrator with the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra. Organizations like yours are taking on more of a role when it comes to arts education. What is the symphony doing?
Good question. There's a lot of things. I'll try to roll through quickly. One of the things I would say first that we're committed to with our programs is we're not necessarily trying to fill gaps that other schools may be creating when they have to cut the arts. We're trying to create opportunities to enhance what the schools already offer, and in some cases use our programs to kind of jumpstart or reinvigorate the programs that once existed in some of the schools. So we have, you mentioned the Youth Symphony. That's a incredibly competitive group for high school students. It's audition, so they have to go through an audition process. And generally, we have about 200 kids audition from the Central PA region. We have 162 this year between two different orchestras. And Stuart's got a few kids in the orchestra as well.
We're very proud of our program as a dad and as a music director.
They play legitimate repertoire. The same repertoire that you would hear the Harrisburg Symphony play is what the kids are dealing with. And they get to perform in the forum, too, so it's a great experience for them. And with their involvement in that group comes a whole host of opportunities for small group and one-on-one work with professional musicians from the symphony, master classes. We also have started to try and help out with this college search process, so bringing in representatives from colleges to talk with the students and the parents about financial aid and what you need to be prepared and how you can be, as you mentioned earlier, kind of that holistically well-rounded student, not just all test scores, but have a lot more to show. So it's a great program. We have a lot to offer. Education side of things, we offer a variety of things. I think probably the biggest programs we look at are our young person's concerts. We do two of them a year, one in the fall and one in the spring. And that's where we do educational programming for school day children. It's basically a field trip for them. So they, the schools get them to the forum, and then Stuart's on stage with the symphony. And in the case of one of the concerts, the Youth Symphony as well. We do a whole concert. We have materials that we send out ahead of time for them. And generally, we hit probably between 3,500 and 4,000 students a year. So it's a great program. And I think probably my favorite program, I say that maybe because it's what my first job with the symphony was a program we're doing actually at Downey Elementary here in Harrisburg. And it's this program called Link Up, which is actually created by Carnegie Hall. And then they have about now over 100 partners worldwide. And they prepare all these materials for educational concerts, and then it's a way to literally link up professional orchestras with schools in their community. And then those kids come to the concert, they're all prepared, it's interactive, and we have a kids' choir on stage singing, and that's where our education program comes in. We have a teaching artist that's at Downey after school every day, and he works with all of the students there, K through fourth grade, preparing them year-round for this material, and then the end result of that is that 100 of these kids get to come to the forum and be on stage, you know, standing behind a full youth orchestra, all of our principal players from the symphony, and the forum is packed for these concerts. So, you know, they're in front of an audience of 1,700 people, all kids, and it's raucous. They're screaming. It's incredible.
But I also see that kind of as the icing on the cake of this really meaty program of kids every single day getting music education.
Hmm. Well, I find it interesting, though, that you say that this was not in response to declining support for the arts, that this was something that you would do anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we realized that that program specifically at Downey, we were committed to doing something in Harrisburg, and Link Up can be used anywhere, but we wanted to work with a district where we didn't necessarily see that there were as many opportunities for students to be involved musically. And then we've actually kind of expanded that. If we look big picture, we're now working on a new program that will actually be in one of the middle schools in Harrisburg. And the intent there is to kind of adopt an El Sistema model of education, which is a program that came out of Venezuela. And the poster child for that program is Gustavo Dudamel, who's the music director for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. But basically, putting instruments in the hands of kids who might not otherwise get them, and then giving them opportunities to be successful. So once that program starts, kind of our hope is that we can kind of see a pathway of K through 12 influence. So a lot of what I work with the folks at the symphony on when we're talking about programs or kind of evaluating what we have is looking at repeat interactions. So rather than we go to a concert once and we maybe don't see those kids again ever, How can we hit a group of kids over and over and over again multiple times and really have a create a pathway for them? So the intent there is that students who will go to Downey and be a part of our program kindergarten through fourth grade, if they start playing an instrument once they go to Marshall, as long as they're a part of the school music programs there. So that's where we get into that enhancing what the school's doing. We're not replacing. We're kind of working alongside the teachers. Then they have a chance to take lessons with us fifth through eighth grade. And then the intent is that hopefully eventually in a couple of years, students have the skills to actually get into our youth symphony program. And that goes sixth through 12th grade. So then we have, you know, essentially a 13-year pathway that we can influence some of these kids.
All right. Curiosity, what instrument's most popular?
In the middle school or in the...
No, we'll start with the kindergarten or fourth grade.
I think the string instruments are probably the most popular some of the kids. There's a few that do everything, but I think the strings are a little less... It's a little easier for the kids to be successful at that age because with some of the brass instruments where you have to use your mouth, it takes a while to figure out how to use all those little muscles.
Caught you off guard in that one, didn't you?
Well, yeah. And they have miniature strings. You can get a 1/16th size violin.
Right. I was just curious because I'm thinking about those kids at that young of an age, what influences them into the instrument that they want to play.
It's a good point, and sometimes it's the parents who influence them. But in the case of these kids, it's they'll hear an instrument and be like, that's the one, mm-hmm. And they'll have days at school, the ones that do have band programs, where they basically play all the instruments, and the kids just decide what they like the best.
Mm. Let's take some phone calls. Judy is in New Cumberland. Judy, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to thank Maestro Molina. The points that you made were excellent. I'm a retired technology and engineering high school teacher, and the interesting thing is, not every student learns the same way, and the connectivity that is provided by music and art education to other areas like science and math is wonderful. I mean, I've had students reach that aha moment when they go to music class and they realize that they are, putting music, and fractions or math concepts together. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your call.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate your point. And I do think that you bring up something that's important, which is the sense of pride. There are kids who get it through sports teams, and I think that's very valid. But there are also kids who are not cut out for sports. I certainly was never athletic. But I got that same feeling of team building and pride through music, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of creating something that's pretty or creating something that people applaud for. I do think that enhances just kids growing up as confident human beings. But it's really nice to hear that your experience bears up what I was talking about.
You know, what's ironic, again, about some of the discussions we're having here is that many of the cities, not just here in central Pennsylvania, the towns here in central Pennsylvania, but across the country, are turning to the arts for their economies. They want to bring people into their cities by using the arts, whether that is art, whether that is music, theater, dance, whatever. So there's some irony there that when we're talking about economic well-being, finances, money, the future, jobs, all those things, that, again, people aren't looking at it that way.
Well, that I think is, certainly for the politicians who don't appreciate the benefit of the arts, there is a huge economic impact of the arts. I mean, and as much in Harrisburg as anywhere else. I mean, there are hotel rooms being sold to our musicians who come in from out of town. There are the restaurants that are thriving before and after our concerts. There are the parking garages that are getting income from people parking. I mean, there are many elements, and it really does go into the millions of dollars, just the symphony's impact on the city's economy and on the region's economy.
Let's take a phone call from Dennis in East Pennsboro Township. Dennis, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. Good morning.
Morning,
Maestro.
Good morning.
You should be in my room right now, 5,200 compact discs and almost as many vinyl LPs.
I love it.
They go the gamut because my doctoral dissertation will be on how rock and roll music of the 50s changed America. But I grew up in a time when the Voice of Firestone was on TV with Howard Barlow conducting the Firestone Symphony Orchestra every Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday night was the Bell Telephone Hour with Donald Voorhees conducting the Bell Telephone Concert Orchestra. We don't have that anymore. Commercial television doesn't give us that anymore. And I'm 71 going on 72. My love for the classics plus the old-time rock and roll is very, very, very deep, and my grandkids are getting exposed to it. You want to come over to this music room? I'll put a pot of coffee on someday, and we can sit and talk about it.
It sounds like a great deal.
Hundreds of books on the topic and on all the topics. We're just not exposed to it. Only public TV does it. Years ago, CBS had Bernstein doing the children's concerts with the New York Philharmonic. That doesn't exist anymore.
Hey, Dennis,
so the kids aren't exposed to it on commercial television. You have to go out of your way to get it.
Thank you very much for your call, Dennis. You know, he's right as far as that exposure outside
Absolutely.
Of just certain places, almost niche places. He's right. Public TV does it. Public radio in some markets does it.
Well, these are interesting problems that we deal with as well as the Harrisburg Symphony. And, for example, the idea of just exposing young kids to great music. We do our young person's concerts. We also have a program called Musical Chairs where children, school-age children up through high school and their parents can get subscriptions for our Masterwork series for just $42 for 7 concerts. Mm-hmm. And we've sold several hundred of those tickets. And I'd encourage anyone who's listening, who's interested in exposing their kids to the arts, to check out HarrisburgSymphony.org for that program. I think it's one of the best things we do. But it's a drop in the bucket, and it can't possibly compare to Leonard Bernstein speaking to millions of people across the country.
Let's speak with Joe in Newville. Joe, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Scott.
Hi, Joe.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I wanted to speak to, it seems like in our popular culture or the environment we're in right now, there seems to be like a contempt for the arts. As to, like at the top of the show, the maestro had to justify even the existence of the arts. And it seems like striving to be, you know, competent or and this is across any medium, like visual or audio, et cetera. But I was wondering, and you did kind of comment on that, but I was wondering if you had anything to say about it.
Well, you know, it's a very good point, and I do think that in some quarters there's a disdain for the arts. I also think that in some quarters there's an intimidation by the arts, that people feel, oh, I'm just not sophisticated enough to understand great art, or I'm not equipped to come to a concert and enjoy it. And I think that is the underlying fallacy that is problematic for not just us, but all arts organizations, all museums, dance companies. The bottom line is art, by its own nature, should be able to speak to everybody. That's not to say that art should be enjoyed by everybody. Some of the art we present might make you angry or might make you profoundly uncomfortable.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because unfortunately, in the society we're in today, politically, many cases were divided. Over the last 20 years or so, there have been those who I would say that have justified their lack of support for the arts because they feel it is too political, or that they see something that say, well, that's not art. Well,
yep.
And again, a lot of that's in the eye of the beholder.
Of course.
But even in this realm, it has gotten political.
Well, you know, when you're talking about the National Endowment of the Arts specifically, I think that the big problem there is that all the publicity has gone to one or two very specific projects that have been controversial. The bottom line about the National Endowment for the Arts is they bring the arts to many millions of people that would otherwise not get them. It's not just giving money to big museums to present controversial exhibitions. I feel that it's already, whenever you start talking about the National Endowment for the Arts, those who are against it will bring up Mapplethorpe, or they'll bring up, and I'm not going to get into my opinions about those things, but I think those are a small slice of what the National Endowment of the Arts is doing. The politicization of every, is that the right word?
If it is,
you think that by now I would know.
Maestro Stuart Molina said it on the radio. It is
okay. the whatever it is of the arts, I think is just, it's another symptom of the breakdown of our society in terms of political polarization. And I think that's sad, because things are in increments. To say I'm against the arts or I'm for the arts is an absurdity. Everyone should be for the arts because the arts represents everybody, in its entirety. It represents humanity. And I would think that even the most furthest to the right and the furthest to the left could agree on that, that great art enhances our lives.
I find it, and I would find it hard to picture people attending one of your shows or any other, sitting there and listening to the music and appreciating the music, loving the music, that they would be sitting there with anger in their hearts. That, I mean, that's what it's there for.
Well,
this is it's to enjoy. It is to bring people together, and it does bring diverse populations together.
Well, and I think that community is an enormous part of live performance of any sort. The caller before was saying that, public television is providing arts for everybody, and they are, and thank goodness for that. But I do think that nothing can compare to a group of people gathering together and experiencing art together. And any artist, any performer will tell you that the audience is an integral part of the performance, as much as the performers are, that there is a synergy between the performer and the audience. That's irreplaceable. If we were performing to an empty room and it were being broadcast to a million people, it wouldn't be the same as having the people there.
I'm curious. You've won a Tony Award.
Yes, I have.
You have led orchestras all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
If you could pinpoint one time where you really, I'm sure you feel that synergy all the time. Synergy is a word we don't use very often anymore. It's kind of, 2000s. But anyway, where you really felt a connection with an audience and said, this is something that this audience really appreciated what we did here tonight.
Well, I'll share one example that was actually fairly recent and certainly not the highest quality performance I've given. I had the opportunity last year to do two tours of Russia through the Russian embassy, through the American embassy in Russia. And we played in a small town called Tolyatti with their orchestra. These were Broadway performances with some really wonderful Broadway singers. The orchestra was not terribly good, but they had worked for months and months and months preparing the music. And I would say the bulk of the audience had never heard any of this music before. And I'm talking about just the classic Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe kind of Broadway, Gershwin, Andrew Lloyd Webber. And the oohs and ahs that we got during the concert, it was palpable, the impact that we were making, not just isn't this beautiful music, but connecting bridges between people that would never otherwise interact with each other. And there were people who said, we've been taught that Americans are horrible, and how can they be horrible producing this kind of music? That was a very powerful experience.
Let's take one more phone call from Heather in Middletown. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in a time where we had art class, gym class, music class, woodworking, home ec, metal class, all during, middle school. And it allowed us, I believe, my generation to be more well-rounded, have a conversation anywhere. It allowed us to have critical thinking skills and be able to troubleshoot. And, what I see today with us taking those things away, being art and music and even the shop classes and the home ec, we have kids that can't make a meal for themselves. They don't have any common sense. They can't troubleshoot. They can't figure out, the way out of a paper bag. And I think our society is losing so much by cutting those things. So thank you.
Heather, thank you very much for your call.
Wow. You've hit on so many amazing, important things. I still am happy that I took home economics because I sew my own buttons and I iron my own shirts. These are life skills that everyone should have. Everyone should be able to cook a meal for themselves. But I also feel that everyone should be able to sing a melody, and everyone should be able to appreciate a work of art on the wall. Yes, I think you lived in a different time. And I talk with my parents, and their music education was different from the music education that my kids are getting. And as Mark hit before, this is not to take anything away from the excellence of the music teachers in our community.
We have fewer of them, a lot fewer of them,
but boy, do they do an amazing job, and they are dedicated in a way that that I'm in awe of. They do work that I couldn't do.
I will give you a plug. Jerry Herman. Tell me about Jerry.
Yeah. Well, there are two sides of Jerry Herman. I'll talk about one side, and then I'll let Mark talk about the other. We're doing our Jerry Herman legacy concert. Jerry Herman, of course, was the great Broadway composer of shows like Hello, Dolly, Mame, right. Mac and Mabel, La Cage aux Folles. And we're doing a concert which celebrates his musical legacy of, you know, many of his greatest hits with some real Broadway stars, people I've worked with before and some who I haven't yet met. It should be a fantastic concert, but what I love particularly about it is the education component that comes with it, and I'll hand over to Mark for that.
So next Monday on the 22nd in the afternoon, we're hosting a masterclass with one of the vocalists and one of the pianists who work with the show and are also part of that production company. And it's open to anybody, but we've put the word out to a bunch of local colleges and gotten some student performers. And so what's really great is they get to work with these artists in this open masterclass style. They get to sing, and, you know, it has to be all Jerry Herman music, obviously. And then at the end of it, the guest artists will choose up to two of the students to actually perform with the symphony that weekend. So there's a really cool kind of in a really quick time frame, you get to kind of see that almost like audition, preparation, rehearsal, concert. You know, and the college students will get to go through that, so it's pretty cool.
I want to thank both of our guests for being with us today. Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra music director and conductor Maestro Stuart Molina, Mark Hunsberger, director of education, youth symphony administrator with the orchestra. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, thank Scott. You so much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Last week, President Trump met with Norway's Prime Minister Erna Solberg and discussed several issues, including the sale of military equipment to Norway and the Paris Climate Agreement, which Trump says the U.S. will leave. Later on in the week came the meeting with legislators from both parties to discuss immigration. That's when the president allegedly made remarks about not wanting immigrants from Haiti and Africa and added that the U.S. should get more people from countries like Norway. So Norway has been mentioned as part of this controversy. Christina Pletten is a journalist who works for Aftenposten, Norway's largest newspaper. She was at the White House with Prime Minister Solberg and later traveled to the Pennsylvania Farm Show. Christina Pletten, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Christina, as I mentioned, Norway, even though Norway wasn't the target or the subject of this controversy, kind of got rolled up into it. So what has the reaction been in Norway to this controversy going on in the United States about the remarks that the President Trump allegedly made?
Well, I think it's been a mix of sort of humorous, a little bit uncomfortable reaction. People here remind President Trump that Norway maybe is not his ideal country. We have universal health care and free schooling and lots of regulations and taxes and things that Mr. Trump basically campaigned against. But also there's, I think, a sense of great uncomfort about being dragged into this kind of discussion that that I think a lot of people are feeling. And then the third thing that has happened is that a lot of people have pointed to Norway's immigration history, which in the 1800s, a lot of Norwegians, Norway was a very poor country. It was maybe the poorest country in Europe, apart from Ireland, and a lot of Norwegians at that time emigrated to the United States and tried to make a living. So that's sort of the gist of the corrections here.
By the way, I should mention that Christina Pletten is speaking to us from Norway this morning. You actually just got back to Norway from the United States. So, you know, we've heard so much about what other nations around the world think of the United States, think of President Trump. So how do Norwegians look at the Trump administration?
Well, it's also a sort of mixed bag. There's a lot of interest in what the Trump administration does, obviously. I think we run anything from 3 to 10 stories every day. There are some very fervent Trump supporters that email me every day telling me that I'm fake news and a liar. And then there's a lot of worry, I think, that there is what seems to be a very unconventional administration. And people are worried about the situation in North Korea. They're worried about NATO. Norway has a border with Russia. So there's a sense of discomfort as well, I think.
You and I had communicated a little bit via email beforehand, and when you said that there is a great interest in Trump, but you also mentioned that that your newspaper, your publication, is struggling with how to cover Trump and the Trump administration. In what way?
Well, one of the things that I think is difficult is that there's a lot of stories published based on anonymous sources and rumor, which is impossible to verify independently. The other thing is that he's creating so much news and discussion and scandal, to put it frankly, through his Twitter and through his remarks. And so we're struggling to figure out, you know, where we should sort of put the bar and what we should cover and what we should leave up to the American media to cover. So it's been a continuous discussion. I think we have it almost every week.
You mentioned that your prime minister Edna Solberg, that, you know, she had an agenda. She had several things that she wanted to talk about with President Trump when she was in White House. I mentioned the sale of military equipment, jet fighters in particular, she was talking about. But here in this country, one of the issues she brought up that got attention was climate change, and that Norway is a really big supporter of the Paris Climate Agreement. Actually, Norway, from what I understand, was one of the first countries to sign on to the Paris Agreement. And she did bring that up with President Trump. And what did she want to say to the president, and what kind of reaction did she get from him?
Well, I think her strategy, and we had a meeting with her before she went to the meeting with Trump, and her strategy was to tie climate change and the environment to business, and to try to convey to the president that there's business opportunity also in green technology, and that there is a danger in sort of being a laggard. So this was her main point. And I also asked, actually, the Norwegian journalist got two questions, and one of them was mine, and I asked him, you know, what it would take for him to reconsider and rejoin the Paris Agreement. And he basically answered what he had said before, that it was unfair and a bad deal. And then he said that he could conceivably go back in, or I guess remain, because you still are not officially out of the agreement. So, and then the prime minister answered that, you know, there are a lot of business opportunity to be had developing green technology, and you know, countries like China and also India are forging ahead with solar panels and electric cars, and so it's becoming a huge industry. And I should mention also that Norway is a huge oil producer, so we have a little bit of a hypocrisy in this green line, because we're also producing a lot of oil. So We're trying to, I guess, make up for it by also focusing on green projects.
But I also understand that up to one-third of the vehicles in Norway are not, you know, they're electric vehicles, that they are not powered by gasoline, correct?
I think new cars, one-third of the new car sales are now electric, and that's because they have tried to encourage this by taking away taxes. And so you don't pay, for instance, when you go on a ferry, you don't pay for parking, you don't pay tolls, and you also don't pay the taxes that you would have to pay when you buy the new car. So there's a lot of Teslas. I think it's the country with the most Teslas. Which she also pointed out to the president, by the way.
Yeah, you led right into my next question. Tesla, of course, an American company, I should say, that she mentioned to President Trump that Norway actually has a trade deficit with the United States.
Right, right. And the president was very happy to hear that. That was also, of course, part of her strategy. I think you may remember that when he visited Germany, he came out with a very angry tweet on his way home about Germany's trade surplus. So the prime minister made sure to mention that was the first thing she said, actually, when they sat down in the Oval Office, that Norway has a trade deficit, which is which hasn't always been that way, but it's basically because of the low price of oil and also because we bought a lot of American warplanes. So that's the main reason for that.
We're speaking with Christina Pletten, a journalist with Norway's largest newspaper, Aftenposten, and she was at the White House last week when Norway's prime minister was there and then made her way to the Pennsylvania Farm Show. So, Christina, I have to ask you about that. Why go from the White House to the Pennsylvania Farm Show?
Well, I'm based in New York, so I was going to go back anyway, and I had a photographer with me, and one of the things that we actually have decided to do more of is to go out and talk to people and see how people live and see how policy actually affects, regular everyday American lives. And I figured that, well, Pennsylvania is a big state, an important state, and also a state that put Trump in office. And we wanted to talk to people about how this first year has been and whether they feel like their lives are better or worse or pretty much the same. And I also wanted to find some local political candidates that have thrown their hat into the ring. And so I spent a day after the farm show with Dennis Wolf, who is a congressional candidate, a Democratic candidate for the 11th District. And he told me a little bit about his reasons to run for office and his thoughts on the political climate.
What did he say?
Well, he's running on a sort of blue dog platform. He said he had never thought about running for office before, but he was mainly running because he wanted to do something about the gridlock in Washington and try to, get things done and get a more sort of grassroots approach. He's running on his background as a farmer. His pitch is that you need more farmers, more everyday people in Washington. So I think we were just talking about the challenges in his district. And I think it's a Republican district, so it's it will be interesting to see, and I'd like to follow his and some other politicians' campaigns through the fall and see, how it plays out.
So
one of the things that I think is interesting to people in Norway is, of course, the balance in Congress, because it affects us also and the rest of the world. So,
what about the people that you spoke with at the farm show? Any surprises there? What did they tell you that Norwegians would be interested in or maybe have an impact on Norwegians?
Well, I don't know that what they told me would have an impact directly on Norwegians. I think that this was a Trump-friendly crowd, obviously, and a lot of people told me that they felt, especially small business owners, they have gotten a better deal as far as taxes, and they feel like customers are spending more money and have more optimism on the economy. And they also, they're also pleased that Trump has rolled back some regulations. So the main impression from the show, I think, was that people there were somewhat pleased. But a lot of people, to be frank, said that they, in their daily lives, they didn't see much of a difference at all.
So I have to ask this question because someone from you know, a European country coming to the Pennsylvania Farm Show, where there is so much food and so much, such a variety of food, such a different culture. Your impressions? What did you eat? What did you drink?
Oh no! there was a lot of fried foods, which is not my favorite. So I had some. I had some vegetable soup, some coffee. I think that was it.
You didn't have a milkshake.
That doesn't sound too European.
Well, Christina Platton, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I'm glad that you had an opportunity to travel here to central Pennsylvania and hear what people had to say. But we'll be looking for your work. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about a recent ruling from the federal government that may seal the fate of Three Mile Island and whether it will be closed or not. This obviously is a big deal here in central Pennsylvania from an economic standpoint. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to research that improves health, reduces recovery times, and brings new treatments and therapies to our area before they're available elsewhere. More information is at upmcpinnacle.com.